My name is Karen Cushman, and I write historical novels for middle school children. Most of my books have been set in England in the Middle Ages, the new ones in the Renaissance, though three of them have been set in the United States. The last one I thought was not even a historical novel. I thought it was contemporary because it was set in 1949, 1950. But when I told that to a group of seventh graders, there was silence. And then one boy said, another historical novel. So I have revised my definition of what a historical
what
novel is.
What history is.
Yes.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. And our first question we are really interested in with writers is, when did you know you were a writer?
As a child, I thought I was a writer. The first thing that I wrote that I still have was a Mother's Day poem for my mother.
And you still have
when
it?
When I was six, yes, that said something like, most greetings are mushy without being real. If you want mush, you want oatmeal. So that showed, I started there with that fine writing and went on from there. But I wrote a lot as a child, all the time. I didn't think about being a writer. Writing was something that I did for myself. It was almost like a place I went to let out all these emotions that weren't allowed. I could be loud or I could be angry. I could mourn. I wrote songs, plays, jump rope rhymes. Novels. I wrote a 7-page novel. I wrote an epic poem cycle based on the life of Elvis. I wrote a play called Jingle Bagels about Santa Claus going down the wrong chimney on Christmas Eve and winding up in a Jewish home. It remains unpublished. So, writing was part of who I was. I wrote. When I got to high school and college, I wrote less. There was more on my plate. When I graduated from college, I didn't write anymore. I think I was intimidated by the word writer, and there were just too many things going on. I used to say, I just have nothing to say. And I didn't write. I did lots of other things, had a lot of jobs, good jobs, no, bad jobs and worse jobs, let's put it that way.
Right.
Got married and had a child, but I didn't write. But over all of those years, I would have ideas, and I'd say to Philip, listen to this, I have a great idea for a story. And I would tell him, and then that would be the end of it. Nothing. And then about 20 years ago, almost now, I woke up one morning with this story in my head, and I said to him, listen to this. I've got a great idea for a story. And he said, you've been saying that for 25 years now, and I've never seen a word. This time, I refuse to listen. But I'll read it if you'll write it down.
Nice.
He's a psychologist. So I did, and I have a 7-page outline for what turned into Catherine Called Birdie, my first book. And once I had some words on paper, I felt committed to it. I wanted to know what happened to this girl. I wanted to work it out. It was almost like a logic problem then to work it out. And so that was a really important step for me, was getting something on paper.
Can I ask you, how old were you when you...
Almost 50.
Right.
Yeah. People ask me how long it took me to write Catherine Called Birdie, and I tell them 50 years.
Yeah.
I didn't seem to be able to do it before then.
You were writing this novel. Did the characters take on a life in your mind, or did they start speaking to you?
No, so I don't have that experience. I always feel like I'm in control.
Good.
And then I'm moving them around. As I said, it's almost like a logic problem.
A Rubik cube.
Yes. How can I make this or show this or display this emotion or how can I get this plot point in and move these people around and do this? I do say to myself, is this something that she would do? Would Lucy really say this if there was a real Lucy? But I never feel like Lucy is speaking through me.
And what about when you got to the end? Did you feel like it was really the end? I mean, did it come to closure?
Yeah, it comes to closure. It comes to the end, and then I send it to my editor, and I find out that it's not finished. And I get a 17-page editorial letter, and work through that. I would say 90% of what she thinks should be done, I will do in some form or another. I don't do exactly what she will ask, or, you know, but she'll say, think about this or that. But I figure she's been doing this for a very long time, and that's her expertise. You know, and so I do pay attention, though she always says, it's your book, you know.
Yeah. Have you been working with the same editor?
Yes. Uh-huh. After I finished Catherine Colberti, I mean, people told me, oh, first novels don't sell, people don't want books about girls, historical fiction, history's dead, you know, nobody's interested. So Phil was saying, I don't care, Will, take out a mortgage and self-publish. But he had just written a psychology book. And I said, well, will you ask your agent if he knows anybody who handles children's books? So he did ask, and his agent, I think as a favor to Phil, said, have her send it to me, I'll see what I can do. So I sent it to him, and he called the next day, and he said, I'll take it. And he lived in the same apartment building in New York as Dorothy Briley, who was at that time editor-in-chief of Clarion Books. And he apparently lurked around the elevator till he saw her one day enter the elevator, and he went in, and he handed it to her in the elevator. And she took it and read it and called back and said, we'll take it. And assigned me to Dinah Stevenson, who is my editor, and she's been my editor ever since.
What did it feel like when you got your first published book in your byline sitting there and it was sent to you, a copy of it?
Well, this may not make it on the tape, but I said, so I've published a book, big deal. And I thought, wait a minute. That's not the right reaction. I think I'm depressed.
Uh-huh.
And and I went and I saw a psychologist, and I did start taking antidepressants because I was just so flat, and that's such a fantastic
postpartum.
Yeah, opportunity just left me kind of flat.
You gave birth.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
Wow.
How long between that first novel and the next?
Oh, as soon as I sent it up, as soon as it went to the editor, to the agent, in fact, I started the next one. I think I enjoyed at that point being a writer, you know, and not Phil's. I had been teaching for 11 years in a university master's program in museum studies, but when you do that, you still have to do the laundry and you still have to cook and clean and stuff. But when you're a writer, I saw once a picture of a woman, I'm still trying to find it, wearing a t-shirt that said, I'm a writer, I don't cook and I don't clean. And I've always wanted one of those t-shirts. Anyway, that's sort of how I felt. Like, I remember when I was pregnant that it was easier just to sit back and do nothing because you were doing something. Even when you weren't doing anything. And I felt kind of like that when I was writing, that it was important enough that I didn't have to do all of these other things. And I had this idea in my head. I had a title, The Midwife's Apprentice. And I liked that title. It spoke of birth and of learning. But I didn't have a clue what the story was about, and I carried it around for a long time. But after the day that I sent off Catherine Colberti, I sat down at the computer, I typed in The Midwife's Apprentice, and I thought, oh God, now what? And then it just started to flow out. It was amazing. That was the easiest book that I have written.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And the most memorable
for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a great work.
Do you ever go back and pick up one of your books and pick it up and look at it and go, did I write that?
I only do that when I'm reading it to illustrate a point or talking to kids and they want some of it. And I say that, but it's usually more negative. And when I'm reading, I'm editing the whole time, so it's not pleasant, you know. I'm changing ors to ands or changing sentences, moving things around as I'm doing that. I don't often sit down and read it for pleasure and say, this is lovely, I did this. I can't do that. I can't shut the editor off at that time, I guess. Yeah.
So you do give talks to kids, and most I'm sure have read one or two or more of your books.
Well, things have changed. When I started out, first of all, it was 7th and 8th graders that I would speak to, and the teachers would sort of do a unit on, let's say, medieval history, and that would be one of the things, one of my books would be one of the things that they would study, and they would spend a lot of time on it, and they'd all be prepared, and every kid who was going to be in the class had to have read one of my books, and they would send home slips of paper saying I was coming, and if you want to buy a book, send the money, and people would send money, and then the kids would all line up afterwards, and I would sign books and sell them. And things have changed, I think, because of economics. I don't sell any books when I speak. I mean, a bookstore might come, but they don't sell very many books. But also, the kids are not prepared in the same way. And they're young. They're like fourth and fifth graders, because the seventh and eighth graders have moved on to vampires and angels and dystopias. This is Otis, my daughter's cat.
Say hello, Otis.
Say hello, Otis.
Otis.
If I pinch you, we'll say hello.
It's wonderful. Which segues to one of the things we're looking and wondering about. There's a tremendous change that's taken place, we all know about, because of both the technology of a computer, as well as the changes in the social fabric as a result of Facebook or Twitter or cell phones. What do you think this portends for writers?
Well, I think there's a couple of questions in there. One is about the technology, and I don't tweet or do Facebook. I think that a lot of writers who write for young adults do that because their people, their audience, is tweeting and doing Facebook. But I don't do that. When it comes to research and technology, it's fantastic. Yesterday, I wanted to find out the place where Samuel Pepys went to the St. Bartholomew's Day Fair in London in 16-something. There is a Pepys online, a searchable Pepys. You can go, you find it. I put in St. Bartholomew, and there it listed all of the entries in which he mentioned that. Unbelievable. When I was doing Alchemy and Maggie Swan, I found an interactive map of Elizabethan London. And it comes up, and you can say churches, and then all the churches will get a little star on them. Or you can say public civic buildings, or you can say, anything, and it will light up. And then you can zoom in, and you can find the streets with their names on them and the big houses. And amazing. Incredible. I was researching broadsides and ballads. There are these ballads from the early 16th century with the original woodcuts and stuff, and they have both pictures of the original ballad, and then they have it written in more modern English so that you can tell what it is, and then maybe even a translation if the language is so far. All of these things are amazing, and I never could have found them if it weren't for the internet. So I think that part is terrific. E-books, I don't know. I'm not of the generation, I think, that's going to read e-books very much, and certainly not write them. I think younger writers are going to have to deal with that more. It is just my hope that whatever format people read with, that they still read, that words are still important, and ideas and history are still important, whether they get it on the computer or on an e-reader or in a magazine or a book or, floating in space behind an airplane, that words and stories are still important.
For people who wish to become writers, what is your advice?
People who wish to become writers need to read a lot. And write a lot, right? Listen well, and I think I would like to see them embrace creativity and not what sells, to write with passion and not with some kind of efficiency. Oh, I even have it here. I have this wonderful quote from Ray Bradbury. Before I started to write Catherine Colberti, we lived in San Diego, and the Los Angeles Times had the big book fair, and Phil and I went up for it, and we heard Ray Bradbury, and he was saying all of these things about know, follow your dreams and write what interests you and write with passion. And I'd never heard anybody say that. I was just so excited. And I was just writing a speech for something I'm doing in Spokane on Saturday, and I quoted him, and I think it fits right here. He said, "To sum it all up, if you want to write, if you want to create, you must be the most sublime fool that God ever turned out and sent rambling. I wish for you a wrestling match with your creative muse that will last a lifetime. I wish craziness and foolishness and madness upon you. May you live with hysteria and out of it make fine stories, which finally means may you be in love every day for the next 20,000 days, and out of that love, remake the world." So when he said that, wow. I got very excited.
Yeah.
You know, remake the world.
Awesome.
That's, you know, what I think all creative people are trying to do in one way or another, some little way to make the world better or brighter. Or
can we take a moment to just see where you write and talk about the
this
actual writing
write.
Process?
This is
the place.
This is a recliner. So I can sit here with my laptop and fight the cat who's trying to get on my lap. One of the reasons that we bought this house was this lovely studio out there. It had been used as a storage area. So we cleaned it all out, put in bookshelves, and put in a floor, and painted the whole thing. Got a little red enamel stove, set it up, rocking chairs, desk, computer. And I went out there, and I hated it. I felt like I was in exile, like I had been thrown out of my home. I have on the second floor a loft that has bookshelves and a comfortable chair and everything. I don't write there either. I somehow want to write right here in the middle of all the action where everything is going on. Now, we don't have a lot of kids. It's just Philip and me and the cat. So it's not like there's chaos around, but this is where I want to be. Just, I had to learn that, you know, through all of this. And I used the laptop because when I was writing on a regular computer, I started to have very bad neck problems. But the laptop has solved that.
Do you write daily?
Well, it depends on what I'm doing. When I'm writing a first draft, it's just painful. So I sit down. First of all, I look on the internet, and I look on the email, and I do this, and I do that, and I have a second breakfast, and I have to do laundry, and all that. I finally force myself to sit down, and I might work for half an hour pulling stuff out of me. Catherine Patterson says it's like a spider spinning a web pulled out of her own guts, and that's very much how I feel when I do that. Then I have to stand up, you know, and walk around. When I'm revising, I find that much easier. I can sit down and do that for long periods of time. I try and write every day. Mm-hmm. I don't write. I should write first thing in the morning. That's my best time. But I am such an ace procrastinator that it does take me a while to get going. And there's so much more to the writing life than just the writing, I've discovered. There are interviews and radio bits and speeches, things like the thing in the talk in Spokane. I'm going to be at the National Council of Teachers of English in November. The Curlan collection, which is the University of Minnesota, it's a collection of children's writers' papers. And it's down in the bowels of the earth. You can see the sides of the Mississippi River, the limestone down there. So if the bomb comes, there will only be cockroaches and these children's literature papers.
Wow.
You know, it's still here. It's just amazing. So I send all my things to them. And a teacher from Texas wanted to do a unit on revising with her kids, helping them edit their own work. So she copied a bunch of my papers and got my permission to have the kids look at them and to compare them and look at the editor's marks and see what I did with it. It's just amazing. And I have 27 versions of the first page of Catherine Colberti. Mm-hmm. And when I speak to kids, I take them. you know, and I show them.
You don't have really 27 exactly, do you?
I counted. Yeah,
really?
I don't think that's all of them.
Yeah.
I didn't write 27 versions of the whole book.
No.
But this, yes, I think it's 27 pages. And there may be more if this is just what I didn't somehow send to the Kurland that I have up there. Yeah.
Good. Is there anything that you'd like to add along these lines that comes to mind?
Oh, I can't remember any of your other questions. I was kind of thinking about
special influences that you might have.
Oh, that's right. Elvis.
Elvis?
When I was a young teenager, a lot of what I wrote this series of poems titled In Defense of Elvis. And I wrote this whole ballad about a rock and rolling shark who was being attacked by people who didn't understand him. It was obviously a metaphor for Elvis. But I found, I guess, that at that point that was my passion, and that's what caused me to write. That's the thing that we're always looking for, you know, is this something that we're passionate about, that we care enough about to sit down and write about. And when I was, I must have been 12, 13, that's who it was. So it was Elvis. When people say, where do you get your ideas? It's happening. Ideas aren't a thing, they're a process. The one example I came up with to use for kids, I tried to say it's like Tinker Toys, but nobody knew what I was talking about. I said, right. You know, Lincoln Logs, they didn't know what I was talking about. So I said, Legos. And Legos is the one. I said, yeah, you have one Lego, one block. It means nothing. And you have another one over here and another one over here. But then you start to put them together, and all of a sudden, one goes on another in your building, and it looks like a train engine or a horse or a house, you know. And you keep adding that's what ideas are like, that they're all coming together.
Did you have a special book when you were growing up that you adored?
We didn't own a lot of books. You know, I grew up in the 40s, and it was not the way things were when Leah was growing up, when, you know, our house almost sank under the weight of her books. What I remember is Heidi. I loved Heidi. And I was young enough so that my mother was reading it to me, and she'd get really sick of reading it to me. When I was a little bit older, I discovered the books of Lois Lenski, who wrote historical novels about immigrant children, prairie. There was one about the prairie. Blue Willow, was that her? Strawberry Girl was hers, about strawberry pickers in Florida, and a couple of others. And the idea that there were people who lived so differently from how I lived in a suburban housing tract in the valley of Los Angeles was eye-opening to me. I remember those quite fondly.
Karen, this has been wonderful. I think this is going to be a great fun interview.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, good.
And I really want to thank you.
Sure.
It's been a...
It was lovely to meet you, Leah said. Oh, you're going to like them. You're going to like them, she said.